Okay.
So, again, we're going to just look at a few topics in how you produce an event-based simulator. So, the two key aspects are the future event list. So, how do you create a list? And then also, how do you generate time? Okay, so the rules or logic, once those are done, are sort of specific to whatever system you're building, so you're going to have to sort of work on those depending on the system. But our event list, well, what we'll suggest is that the easiest thing is a linked list. And we'll see why we would want to create a structure like that. And then in terms of time, again, we'll see how we would go about generating numbers, times that look random and look like they're distributed and according to a certain distribution. Okay. So our event list, well, we can think of it as being ordered according to the time of occurrence of events. And we therefore need a number of basic operations to manipulate that list. If we have an ordered list, well, we need to be able to remove events from the list, and we need to add events to the list. We should note that we don't necessarily know in advance how many events we'll have in the list. Okay. And so there's a number of sort of standard ways of representing lists of non-determinate length, and the one that we'll be suggesting again is the linked list. So, have you guys all seen linked lists before? Or yes. Okay, so I'll go through it reasonably quickly then, and just remind you of what the benefits of linked lists are. Okay. And so, a linked list again is a way of implementing a list structure without having items sort of have to be physically in order. Or even grouped together. And so that should be contrasted with a list where physical position is important. And so if we even think of maybe writing something down on a piece of paper, if we want, say, an alphabetized list of class members or club members or members of a group, then we can just write them down, and the ordering is implicit in the physical position of the group members. So the problem with this is, there's a number of problems with this. The first of which is, what if we want to add to that list? Okay. If physical position is important, then we're in trouble. Okay. If this is a list I just wrote down on a piece of paper, I'm going to have to rip up that list and rewrite everybody again. If these are memory positions, so you've added the list as an array, say, then you're still not really out of the woods, because you're going to have to, you find out where Jane gets inserted, then you're going to have to move everybody down by one. So you're physically going to have to copy over a lot of data in order to insert Jane into that list. Furthermore, if you do think about storing this sort of information about an array, as an array, then there's a fixed size to that array, and that's going to fix the size of your list. If for some reason your list gets longer than that, again, you're in trouble. If you've written your code well, you notice this and don't have, stop. If you haven't, possibly you're bleeding over the end of your array. Okay. So we'd like some way to represent our lists where physical location is not significant. Okay. And so we can think about, again, just putting our names sort of anywhere. Okay. Now, that's fine. You've got everything stored. Obviously, the problem with that is that position now, that you have no relation between the members of the list, and you want to have some relation. So you add additional information. Which connects these entities together. Okay. And so we essentially add the information of the location of the next member in the list. Okay. So we have to start, so we indicate a list head. Then we attach to Albert some information that the next member is Fred, to be found here. And Fred has information about where to find the next member on the list. And then Jane has information about where to find the next member on the list. Okay. So, if we then need to add another member, well, we're just changing these arrows. Okay, we can store the next member anywhere we like. Okay, so this allows us to dynamically allocate space based on the size of the list. And ordering is then, again, indicated, the ordering of the list is indicated through this additional information. Okay, so instead of having your data, you have your data plus, again, the pointer to the next piece of information. And so again, our list operations typically revolve around changing pointers. Okay, so if you add a node, you need to find the place where you're adding it, and then you, instead of having the two nodes point to each other, the node points to the new node points to the old node. Okay. The price you pay for structuring the list in this way is that when you search through the list, you have to examine each member in turn. It's not possible to sort of jump into the middle of the list. Okay, so if we want to find a specific element, then we'll have to start at the beginning and keep examining our list members. Again, deleting a node is, again, a matter of changing our pointers. Okay. So, back in the days of C, you would have to define the appropriate data structure and mess around with the pointers, and it generally took a while for people to wrap their heads around the concepts. The nice thing about Java is that it does all that for you. Okay, so that's, as I said at the beginning, you can do your project in whatever language you want, but Java does sort of have nice classes and support that make these things easy. Okay. So, Java has what's called a list iterator, which, again, keeps track of the position you're in the list, and then you can, do your additions and deletions relative to that position. Okay, and so hopefully that link is still active, but again, you just need to look at list iterators. Okay. So again, the main drawback of linked lists is that the only way to search through the list is to start at the beginning and move from element to element to element to element, which means whenever you perform a search, you could potentially be traversing, having to examine the entire list to find whatever element you want. Okay, so there are snazzier structures, such as heap structures, which would allow you to perform that search quicker. Okay, so again, Paris discusses these structures, our simulations aren't going to be overly large, so in general, linked lists will be fine, and you won't take too much of a performance hit. Okay. So again, the idea here is that you'll have your future event list. You've ordered it, so when it comes time to advance the simulation, your event advance, you just look at the first element of that list. As a combination of state and event, you should be able to determine what future events then you're going to generate by the occurrence of that event. Okay. Your future events then will need to be inserted in order. Okay, so they'll be done in ordered according to their clock values. So, pretty much the last question we're going to look at today is, how do we generate these clock values? Okay. So, if you think about our queue, we've got inter-arrival times. We've got service times. Okay, and these are not deterministic. They're probabilistic, and they follow some sort of distribution. Okay. So when we generate, and so what we're doing, when we run our simulation, again, we're picking a single instance among all possible instances, but we want that instance, well, you can't say anything about a single instance, obviously. It's just a number. It does have a probability associated with it, but any given number is possible. But if you see a sequence of them, then you would like to say that sequence looks like it's adhering to a distribution. Okay. So if you think your numbers are uniform between 0 and 1, you would be getting uncomfortable if you saw a sequence of all zeros, or a sequence where everything's under a half. You'd be going, doesn't really look like it's adhering to the distribution I want. And similarly, if you have something like the exponential, you'd expect more small numbers and then less large numbers. Okay. So if you pick out any one number, you can't say really anything about it, but if you look at a sequence, you'd like to say that, yeah, the sequence looked plausible, and we'll return to what techniques we can use to verify that. What we're going to look at today is what techniques can we use to generate these sorts of sequences. Okay. So if we're simulating our MM1Q, then we want all our inter-arrival times to, for instance, be exponential, and our service times to be exponential. And so, again, we want our sequence of times to look like it might plausibly, if you look at a big sequence of times, you want it to look plausibly like it might have been generated using a certain distribution. Okay. And typically we're going to generate these sequences of random variates. So the random variate, again, that's just the sequence that we generate, and we're going to generate that sequence in two steps. First, we're going to generate pseudo-random numbers, or we refer to as random numbers, which we assume are distributed uniformly between 0 and 1. And we'd like that to be in some sort of statistically independent way. And for true independence, you're going to have to require that there's no repetition, but typically, there will be eventual repetition, but we hope that that's at a long enough period that for our purposes, it looks we don't observe that repetition. Okay. We may or may not want to be able to reproduce the same sequence over and over again. It can be handy to actually be able to do that. Although, again, if it's reproducible, it's not completely random, hence the pseudo in front of the random. Okay. Once we have this sequence of random variates, typically we can use that sequence, manipulate that sequence to give us a sequence of random variables to give us a sequence of random variates that look like they're distributed according to some other cumulative distribution function. Okay. And we'll see how that's done. Yeah, in a minute. Okay. So, again, at the core of this, we want to generate the sequence of random numbers, which look like they're drawn from the uniform 0-1 distribution. Okay. We'll then use that sequence to generate sequences that look like they're drawn from other distributions. Okay. So, the first question then becomes, how do we generate our random numbers? So how do we generate a sequence of numbers that looks uniform? There's two possibilities. There are natural phenomena which are genuinely random, and so you can observe one of those and convert that observation into numbers, but that's not necessarily that easy. And as I said, sometimes you actually want to have something that's more predictable. Okay. In the second case, we can use sort of generation techniques, which are based on certain initial conditions, and then based on your initial condition, you move forward and generate a sequence of numbers. Okay. If you use the same initial condition, then you get the same sequence again and again. So, a number of algorithms exist for producing these pseudo-random sequences. We're going to look again at the very simplest of them just to get an idea of how they work. And a lot of the more complicated ones are just you hook a bunch of the simpler ones together in certain ways. How good a generator is evaluated on how closely the sequences mimic truly random behavior. So there will be a bunch of tests in terms of whether the numbers are all going up or down, or how they cycle around a mean. Okay. And so we'll have a look at a few of the tests and see how these would be used to mimic our random behavior. Okay. Again, fortunately for us, people have done all of this and in general have provide good techniques for generating these random numbers. But again, we'll just see what's the basis for those sorts of techniques. Okay, so again, our uniform distribution, the PDF, is just f of x is 1 for 0 less than or equal to x less than or equal to 1, 0 elsewise. Obviously, the expected value then is a half, and you can work out then the variance is a 12. And there would be a few basic properties that you would expect these numbers to exhibit. And so if we look at, again, if we generate the sequence and we look at, and we subdivide our interval into n little n subintervals, you would expect the number of occurrences within each of the subintervals to be roughly equal. So that makes sense. It's uniform, so you wouldn't want, if you have two subintervals, so you wouldn't want everybody in one of them and nobody in the other, because then you'd be going, looks like it's uniform between 0 and a half, not between 0 and 1. Okay, and you would, again, like that the probability of observing a value in a particular interval is independent of the previous value, so knowing the history doesn't help you predict what the next value is. Now, that's within reason. Obviously, if you know how the generation was done, you can predict however many you want, but assuming you don't know how the generation was done, but just observe values, then you shouldn't be able to predict next values. Okay. So we'll give an example of one method for generating our random numbers, or pseudo-random numbers, and that's called the congruential method. And the congruential method generates the sequence recursively using the formula xi plus 1 is axi plus c mod m. Okay. Or you can generalize that to different formulae, usually typically linear formulae, and have a greater history. Okay. So all of your numbers that you're going to generate this way are going to be integers between 0 and m minus 1. To get into the range 0, 1, we just divide by m. So you have to be clever about how you pick your parameters, A, C, and M, to arrive at acceptably random results. And so, again, the example we're going to go on to is not very random at all, we'll see. But generally, again, there exist values that are proven to have good properties, and so you would just use one of those values. Okay. And so, just to see, take a look at how this works. Okay, so we have an initial condition, that's our seed, x0 equals 0. We let A equals C equals 7, and then M equals 10. Okay. And so the sequence of numbers generated, you start with 0, so you get 7 mod 10 gives you 7. 7 times 7 is 49, plus 7 is 56, mod 10 is 6, 6 times 7 is 42, plus 7 is 48, mod 49, mod M is 9, 9 times 7 is 63 plus 7 is 70, mod 10 is 0, and what we see is, well, we're back to our 0 state, so we're just going to repeat from then on. Okay. So again, this is not terribly random. Probably after you saw 2 cycles, you'd be sort of getting the idea of what's going on, and we'd start predicting what was coming up. So again, that's a bad example of a generator, but again, it just gives us the idea of how it works. This one's a good example of a generator. Okay. So, for that form of generator, there's a few properties, the most important of which is that the maximum periodicity you can get is M. Obviously, after M, you've cycled through all the numbers, so you're arriving, you have to arrive back at a state you were in before. Okay. What you would like is to ensure that you get to that M without repeating. Okay. So, again, there are conditions given at which you will arrive at a period of M. So M and C have no common divisors. A mod R equals 1 whenever R is a prime factor of M, and A mod 4 is 1 if M is a multiple of 4.
Sorry, where does the R come from?
Sorry?
A mod R?
Yeah, so R is, this is just the condition. So for any prime factor of M, we call R.
Okay.
Then we require that A mod R be 1. And so, for instance, 5 is a prime factor of M. A mod 5 of 7 mod 5 is not 1, so our condition isn't holding. Okay. So, again, you can sort of do more and more complex generators, which may or may not have better properties. Okay. And so, I'd say a fair few PhD theses went into sort of describing various generators and assuring us that they have properties, suitable properties. Again, for us, we're going to use what's provided by Java. In a couple of lectures, we will sort of return to the idea of assuring ourselves that it actually is suitably random. Okay. So again, probably any distribution that you will need to use included in the random class in java.util. Okay. And so typically you can either choose your own seed, or if you leave that blank, then it'll choose a seed based on the system time. Okay. So, again, if you produce your own generator, you're going to want to assure yourself that the observed numbers actually do look suitably random. Did I do that here? No, I didn't. Good. And we're we will return to that idea two lectures hence. Okay. So we will look at tests by which you can observe if you have a sequence of numbers. You can assure yourself that it's plausible that they had a certain had the underlying uniform distribution, and so these would fall into the category of ensuring that, again, if you look at subintervals, that they're all roughly the same amount. You'd be surprised if they were exactly the same amount, but you wouldn't want them there to be too many outliers, and the chi-square test will say something about that. And then beyond that, looking not just at sort of the distribution of the numbers, but also looking at the sequencing of the numbers. So, for instance, if the numbers keep going up, keep going up a half, three quarters, five sixths, you would begin to suspect again that that didn't look that random. Okay. And so there's a numbers of runs tests that deal with it, with not just the actual numbers, but the sequencing of the numbers. But we'll return to that. Okay. So our last question is just, given we now have the sequence of numbers which we are happy is distributed or looks distributed, uniform 0-1, and we then ask the question, can we generate sequences that look like they're distributed according to other distributions? So exponential, for instance. And so the first technique that's worth trying is what's called the inverse transform technique. And here, okay, so we let R be our sequence of random numbers, and we assume we have the cumulative distribution function for the distribution that we want our numbers to adhere to. And so what we do is we let, and that's, we call our CDF f of x. And we set r equal to f of x, which, and of course, what we really want is x. So then x is the inverse CDF applied to r. Okay, and again, what we'd like to do is convince ourselves that that gives us the appropriate distribution for x. So, what we need to do is see if we can determine what the probability that x is less than some fixed value x, well, that's our CDF. We want to arrive back at the appropriate one. But our x is f inverse of r. So what that means that we're trying to prove, we're trying to find the probability that f inverse of r is less than x. So that's again, x is in this point. But that's tied to R
the probability that R is less than f of x, since R is f of x. Okay. Now, so if the probability that x is less than x is the same as the probability that R is less than f of x, but the probability that R is less than f of x is just f of x, right? Because we have a uniform distribution, the probability that R is less than a half is a half. Less than 3/4 is 3/4. Okay. So, what we've shown there then is that if we generate our x's in this way, and if we accept that our r's have this uniform distribution, then our x's have the distribution that we're looking for. They do adhere to our cumulative distribution function. Okay. So, just to see how this works, we'll start with our exponential distribution. So the PDF is lambda e to the minus lambda x. Our CDF is 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. So we set r equal 1 minus e to the minus lambda x, and we solve for x. And so you get that x is minus 1 over lambda, that's your log 1 minus r. And in this case, we do a trick and say, doesn't matter if it's r or 1 minus r, because we should be equally likely to be sort of above or below. Okay. So, what we have now, so that's for each r. So if we have a sequence of r's, we get a sequence of x's now, and that sequence ought to look like it's exponentially distributed. And what does that mean? It means that it ought to look like you should have more values sort of in the lower ranges and then the rare value moving out, okay? As opposed to all of the values, you know, sort of equally distributed. You can think about changing to a different uniform distribution, so no longer over 0, 1. So we have our PDF, f of x is 1 over the length of the interval, b minus a in this case. And so to get the CDF, you just integrate, and that should be a capital F. And you get x minus a over b minus a, set that equal to r, and solve for x, and you get x as a plus b minus a times r. Okay. And, you know, if you think about it, again, you should see that you're at both, you achieve both ends of the range, depending on whether r is 0 or 1, but again, should be uniformly distributed between that, because r was uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. Okay. So that's great as long as we can actually invert f of x, which we can't always. If we can't invert f of x, then there's a series of tricks that we can possibly use to come up with our variance. Okay. So
The Erlang K distribution represents the sum of K IID exponential random variables. Okay. And so it's not, it's not easy to directly produce and invert our CDF, but we can just construct by knowing what we're representing. So we know we're summing K exponential random variables. We already decided how we can generate exponential random variables, so we just sum up K of them, and that's our Erlang random variable. Okay. Again, our normal distribution. We can't even find a closed form for our CDF. So we aren't going to be able to directly apply our inverse transform technique. So what we do is we adhere to the central limit theorem. Okay, so again, we produce it by sort of a direct construction. And what the central limit theorem says is that if you have IID random variables and you sum up enough of them, they start to take on a normal distribution. Okay. And so once we have something that has the right shape, we just have to match up the mean and the variance. Okay. So, again, our central limit theorem. If we have IID random variables, we know there the mean and the variance of each individual random variable. Then, if you sum up enough of them, then the distribution approaches a normal distribution with a mean k mu and a variance k sigma. So, what are we starting with? We're starting with our random numbers, so our variables have a distribution uniform 0, 1. And if we sum up a bunch of those, then the sum of them should be distributed normal with a mean of k over 2 and a variance of k over 12. Okay. You can normalize that by subtracting off the mean, dividing by sigma, and you get something normal 0, 1. And then we equate that to x, which again, if we subtract off the mean and divided by sigma is normal 0, 1. And just, you know, again, directly solve for x, and you have produced, you've constructed x as a sum of these initial normal 0, 1 random variables. Okay. Again, for Poisson processes, we, you know, again know we're able to do the construction by knowing essentially what the interpretation is and how the original Poisson process was constructed. Okay. So,
need to do is to essentially, if we have a count here, so we need to, we want to know essentially how many it would take to exceed the value of n, and this gives us the number of occurrences of a Poisson distribution. Okay, so you add up a bunch of our R's, some random number of these R's, and the number that you need then is how many of the R's does it take to reach a sum of 1. Okay, and so that number, the number of R's, is what gives you your variate n. Okay, so again, by knowing how the process works and what the interpretation of the process is, we're able to construct directly our variate. Okay. So just the final one. In some cases, we may want to match our distribution to actual data. So we've made some observations about traffic loads or something similar to traffic loads. And so we want to run our simulations using similar but not necessarily identical loads. And so typically what you would want to do in that case is sort of use your observations to generate either a density function or discrete probabilities, or a CDF if it's not, if they're continuous. And then when you've generated that, then you can essentially use your inverse transform, your inverse transform technique. Okay. So if we have discrete numbers, then we have our CDF jump with each number, and we just for each R we see which interval we're in and then assign the number to the number associated with that interval. And so, again, if you have a continuous probability distribution, the only issue, obviously, is that you you can't determine that distribution necessarily from just observing a finite number of samples, but you can use something like a histogram to get the general shape of that distribution. And so you can use that to construct a CDF, which is, again, piecewise continuous, and then use your inverse technique. Okay. So, again, when you go to do your assignment, you're just going to use what's available to you in Java, and that will be sufficient. But underlying that are algorithms like the ones that we've looked at here.
So, just to summarize, our discrete event simulations are a way for us to study system behavior. They do give us a mathematical representation, but they're giving us a single, or any simulation run is giving us a single instance of an infinite number of possible system behaviors. Okay, so we're going to have to decide what we can actually conclude from observing now a single instance or a handful of instances of system behavior. In terms of constructing our simulation models, we're looking at discrete event simulation models and within that event advance models. And so the core of the event advance model is the future event list. And so you have this future event list, and then you have rules for how that changes as events occur. All of this is based on timing, and usually for anything interesting, we're assuming that timing is random according to some distribution. So again, the last thing we looked at was how do you actually generate our random variables. So next week, we'll cover the topic of how you interpret the results you observe from your simulation models, and how can you get sort of statistically relevant conclusions out of your simulation models. So have a good weekend, and I'll see you all next week.